Our parents do not tell us that much, I mean, that much cozy, right? I want to say that even as soon as the children are growing older, they usually say less of such statements and words. But we see that the Imam says, no, I'm not indifferent towards the issue. I'm always caring for you, right? He's kinder than the parents, kinder than the mother and father. We have not yet understood who this person that you are going to have contact with is. What characteristic he has and what spiritual beauties this person have that he's in search of us. Are we expecting such a thing happen overnight? For example, oh, I have tried a light, but I couldn't meet Imam Ali Salam. No, Imam does not exist because I didn't meet him. So whatever you do not see or whatever you do not visit does not exist?
No.
I'm asking you.
It's not like that.
I'm asking you, do you see the pain?
No.
Do you see the prosperity? Do you see happiness of a person while he's not laughing? Whatever it cannot be seen does not necessarily mean that it does not exist. So Imam does exist and he has relation with some. And if we try our best, this relation can happen. But how?
Thank you, Brother Ali, for your elaboration, for your beautiful examples about the love of Imam for us. And the interesting fact that this love and this relation starts from Imam himself towards us. And the next level of actually analyzing this topic is about how can we be at the position and status of actually mutual partner and the other side of this relationship, which it's going to be discussed after a short break.
أهدى سنه مهديون في الأزمان شع ضيه ربنا في العالمين أضفع له نور أليق والظالم ابتدأ من أجل السالكين.
So welcome back, dear listeners. This is the program, The Last Savior. And in this part, we're going to talk more about the characteristic of a true follower of Imam as a party of this unconditional love that Imam will give us.
Well, we need to start this relation with deep heart relation, with a deep heart contact. I mean, it can start from, again, from whatever they have taught us. I mean, in the language of narrations, we see lots of supplications that they are very beautiful. They tell us, okay, peace on you at the time that you stand, at the time that you sit. Look, this is sort of loving sentences that we tell to the beloved.
Yeah.
You see, when such relation had started, then slowly we see that okay, something comes up. I mean, but this contact, if a person has the tawfiq, the blessing to had the honor of meeting Imam alayhi salam, will have either a visit of Imam in person or a heart contact. So what do we mean by this too? When a person has the tawfiq to meet Imam alayhi salam in person, it is either of these two ways. While he meets Imam, but he doesn't know that he is the Imam himself. So he has a good talk, or he or she can have a pretty good talk with Imam alayhi salam and everything. And when after finishing this talk, he or she understands that, oh, it was Imam alayhi salam. You see? And this kind of relation has been narrated and has been mentioned and has been documented by some. And sometimes when a person is that strong enough, like the ones that who have worked on themselves a lot and they have observed taqwa in the best way possible, so they meet Imam and they know that he is the Imam, they know that the person that they are meeting is Imam alayhi salam. This is a higher level of meeting. So he knows that he has this spiritual readiness, and he had worked on himself to get rid of the sins and committing different kinds of major minor sins, and he reached to this merit of meeting Imam alayhi salam in person. And this is a really great tawfiq.
Exactly.
And for those who had this chance, this is not an easy thing to happen, I mean, overnight.
Sure.
But it requires lots of work and ourselves. That is من عرف نفس فقد عرف رب. That if we work on our soul and our nafs, then the ma'rifa and knowledge of Allah will be also possible for us. So this is one aspect. The second kind of meeting or having a relation with Imam is a heart contact of Imam. That is, some people see Imam alayhi salam and yeah, they cannot talk, they cannot say anything, they just see, but they have a sort of heart contact with Imam alayhi salam. It happened even at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The way that Uwais al-Qarani, yeah, I mean the status and relation of the Holy Prophet and him, the Prophet entered the masjid and said, I'm tasting the smell of Uwais, is he here? But he left already. And you see that the Prophet actually explains and describes Uwais in the very beautiful way, while he hadn't met him even for a single moment.
Yeah.
So how does it happen? This is sort of relation specifically belonging to infallible and companions and followers and those who are with him.
May Allah hasten his reappearance and bless us with the love of Imam and with his contact and his members in our heart. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road? Please, oh please, please come.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's asylum laws have introduced a perma-backlog of up to 55,000 people who cannot have their claims processed and risk being left indefinitely in taxpayer-funded temporary accommodation. The Institute for Public Policy Research said that anyone arriving in the United Kingdom via irregular means after 20th of July 2023 cannot have their claim processed and instead will be removed to their home country or to a third country such as Rwanda following the introduction of the Illegal Migration Act. At the same time, pre-existing laws mean that Irregular arrivals since 7th of March 2023 cannot be given permission to stay. The think tank said reports suggest that these claims are also on hold. The report says it is highly doubtful that the small country of Rwanda will ever be able to accept tens of thousands of people. Marley Morris, Associate Director for Migration at the Institute for Public Policy Research, said chaos in the Home Office has led to tens of thousands of asylum seekers stuck in a perma-backlog, unable to get on with their lives and costing the taxpayer millions of pounds. This was an entirely predictable outcome of the Illegal Migration Act. The only way to escape this situation is for the Home Office to start processing claims. The Institute for Public Policy Research's warning came as James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, said wealthy nations must help developing ones avoid hemorrhaging people. In a speech in New York on Tuesday, 27th of February, James Cleverly said Western powers must help would-be migrants to stay and thrive at home in order to stem the international migration crisis. Answering questions afterwards, he said there could be large-scale migration to Europe from Africa, the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, as they become richer and people who were previously too poor to consider relocation acquired the financial means to do so. James Cleverly said, as these parts of the world become wealthier, there may be an initial but potentially temporary pressure for large-scale human movement to the high GDP per capita countries. He argued that Western powers should support these countries in ensuring they are safe and prosperous to prevent an outflow of people and a devastating talent drain. He said, "If you're a country with great aspiration for your future, but what you're synonymous for is just people hemorrhaging from your country, that contradicts your message." An expert in migration questioned James Cleverly's plan. Madeleine Sumption, the director of the Migration Observatory, said research suggested development policies were not an effective way to reduce migration. She added, "It's usually not the very poorest people who migrate, because migrating requires resources. So if low-income countries get richer, sometimes that leads to more migration and not less." She added, "Countries have to become pretty wealthy before people stop wanting to emigrate in substantial numbers. If governments knew how to implement development policies that could achieve that, they'd have done it already." A spokesperson for the Home Office claimed, "We met the Prime Minister's pledge to clear the legacy backlog of asylum cases made before 28th of June 2022, and all of those cases have been reviewed. Now we're working through the next cohort of applications." The spokesperson asserted, "We're beginning to implement measures in the Illegal Migration Act following the Supreme Court judgment on Rwanda and alongside the Safety of Rwanda Bill going through Parliament, delivering against this government's priority of tackling illegal migration." British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. The prosecutions have largely slipped under the radar, although the issue has been highlighted by the case of the Senegalese teenager Ebrahim Abar. He was sentenced to 9 years and 6 months detention after being convicted of 4 counts of manslaughter and 1 of facilitating a breach of immigration law after steering an overcrowded dinghy that got into difficulty, leading to the drowning of at least 4 people. The report, called No Such Thing as Justice Here, from the Centre for Criminology at the University of Oxford and Border Criminologists, examined the cases of people who have been imprisoned for their arrival on a small boat since the Nationality and Borders Act of 2022 came into force. It used a mix of attendance at more than 100 court hearings, as well as freedom of information requests and interviews with lawyers, convicted asylum seekers, convicted and interpreters. The non-governmental organisations Humans for Rights Network, Captain's Support UK and Refugee Legal Support contributed to the report. It found that the prosecutions have not acted as a deterrent for channel crossings and calls for an end to criminalisation at the border. Between June of 2022 and October of 2023, 253 people were convicted under Section 24 of the 1971 Immigration Act for illegal entry and 7 under Section 25 of that Act for facilitation. According to the research, those targeted for prosecution were either boat drivers like Ibrahim Abar or had immigration history in the United Kingdom, such as having made a previous visa application. In 2021, a series of successful appeals overturned prosecutions under these sections of the 1971 Immigration Act. In response, in June of 2022, the Nationality and Borders Act expanded the scope of criminal offences relating to irregular arrival to the United Kingdom. The offence of illegal arrival was introduced, with a maximum sentence of 4 years imprisonment, and the offence of facilitation was expanded, with a maximum sentence increased from 14 years to life imprisonment. In 2022, 1 person for every 10 boats was arrested for their alleged role in steering. In 2023, this increased to 1 for every 7 boats. People have been identified as having their hand on the tiller for many reasons, including having boating experience, steering in return for discounted passage, taking it in turns, or being under duress. Those arrested included people from countries with a high asylum grant rate, including Sudan, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Syria. Children in age disputes have been charged as adults with the offences of illegal arrival and facilitation for their alleged role in steering boats across the channel. Humans for Rights Network has identified 15 age-disputed children who were wrongly treated as adults following Home Office age assessments and charged with these new offences, with 14 of them spending time in adult prison. They believe there are likely to be more cases. So far, 5 have been confirmed to be children, and the outcome of age assessments is awaited for the others.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, we both have a physical body and a spiritual body. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an honor here, dear friends, talking about Islamic lifestyle. So we want to talk a little bit about this idea that we have both a physical body and a spiritual body, if you will. So, of course, we all know about our physical body. We know, you know, that we grow. We know, you know, our hands, our feet, our eyes, our ears, this physical body that we all have. Now, what's really interesting is, when it comes to lifestyle in general, people have a tendency to really take care of their physical body. It's interesting, there's so many different products, and there's so many different diets, and there's so many, different guidelines that the modern world has come up with for us to be physically fit, for us to be physically strong and capable of doing what we need to do in our lives. It seems like there's just a new fad or a new diet that's out there all the time trying to promote itself as being, the best way to keep physically fit. So this is one aspect of the body. And when we're talking about a Islamic lifestyle, of course, one of the important aspects of a Islamic lifestyle is to have a healthy physical body. And this physical body is really, what we use to walk around. And it's interesting, in a lot of the traditions, we find that physical fitness and physical health is considered to be one of the greatest benefits and one of the greatest blessings that Allah, the Almighty, has given every single one of us. And truly, when an individual becomes sick or they're ill or ailing, that's when you really begin to understand the importance of the physical body. Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how we both have a physical body and a spiritual body. Now, we talked in the first segment a little bit about physical body and how it's really important, and it is considered to be one of the greatest blessings of the Almighty Allah is to have a physically fit, a physically healthy body. But of course, we spend so much time on this physical body of ours, we really should think about the spiritual aspect of each and every single one of us. And just as we have certain diets and we have certain guidelines in order to keep the physical body fit and healthy, we also have spiritual guidelines and spiritual diets, if you will, in order to keep our spiritual life healthy. It's interesting that both of these must be in balance, both the physical body and the spiritual body, quote unquote, even though the spirit is not necessarily contained within a vessel, if you will. But we have spiritual aspect of the human being and we have the physical aspect of the human being. And Islam beautifully addresses both the physical needs as well as the spiritual needs of human beings. Now, this connection with the Almighty Allah, this behaviors and morals and manners and virtues that every single one of us try to achieve in our lives, these are all are part of our spiritual self, these moral ethical virtues which elevate every single one of us and make us into better human beings trying to achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The Limelight.
Donald Trump, his adult sons, and former Trump Organization officials have appealed a civil fraud judgment in New York. The former president's lawyers asked New York State's mid-level appeals court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's verdict. we take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump, his adult sons, and two former Trump Organization officials have appealed the $464 million judgment entered against them in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case. The Trumps filed a notice of appeal with the court on Monday, 26th of February. The first business day after Judge Arthur Engoron made the judgment official. Donald Trump is personally on the hook for $454 million, including interest payments. In the court filing, the attorneys said they were appealing the money, judgment, and other relief, including the bans against the Trumps for serving as officers of New York corporations for a period of years, and whether the judge committed errors of law and or fact, abused its discretion, and or acted in excess of its jurisdiction. It was not immediately clear how Donald Trump planned to cover the money needed for the appeal. Trump will need to put up cash or post bond to cover the $355 million and an additional roughly $100 million in interest payments he was ordered to pay. His sons were each ordered to pay more than $4 million back in gains they improperly received because of the fraud. If he does not provide all those dollars, then that interest is going to keep ticking throughout the entirety of the case, said Jeremy Salland, a criminal defense attorney. The bottom line is that he's in trouble. He doesn't have to put up the money to appeal. He puts up the money to stop bleeding more money. The way to cover that wound is with cash, Salland said. Interest accrues at an annual rate of 9% until the payment is made in full, according to lawyers. If Donald Trump posts a bond, which could be backed by properties or other assets, it stops the Attorney General from seizing his property. Donald Trump could also ask the appeals court to stay the judgment or ask them to not require him to post the money until later. Some lawyers say it's more common for companies to have to post judgments of this amount, but the sheer size of it for an individual is in some ways uncharted territory. The Trump Organization is a private entity and much about its financial state is closely guarded. Donald Trump said under oath last year that he had more than $400 million in excess cash. The New York Attorney General's office said in court filings last year that in 2021, Donald Trump had about $200 million in cash tied up in a partnership with Vornado. If Trump were to sell a property to raise money, that could take months, may require approval by the monitor put in place as a result of the investigation, and requires signing off by the Attorney General, Letitia James. It would also likely result in a large tax bill. If Trump's appeal is successful, or the court reduces the amount of money owed, he would be able to recover money he has posted down the road. Judge Arthur Engoron's signed judgment was posted to the court docket on Friday, 1 week after he found Donald Trump Jr., and Eric Trump liable for fraud in the civil case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. The judge denied a request from Trump to delay the judgment for 30 days, saying they didn't explain or justify a reason to do so. His lawyers had argued it would harm the New York Attorney General's office and would allow for an orderly process given the magnitude of the decision. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump has appealed his $454 million New York civil fraud judgment, challenging a judge's finding that the former president lied about his wealth as he grew the real estate empire that launched him to stardom and the presidency. The former U.S. president's lawyers filed notices of appeal on Monday, 26th of February, asking New York State's mid-level appeals court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's 16th of February verdict in the lawsuit brought by the New York Attorney General Letitia James and reverse staggering penalties that threaten to wipe out Donald Trump's cash reserves. Trump's lawyers wrote in court papers that they were asking the appeals court to decide whether Judge Arthur Engoron committed errors of law and or fact, and whether he abused his discretion or acted in excess of his jurisdiction. Trump's appeal paperwork did not address whether Donald Trump was seeking to pause collection of the judgment while he appeals by putting up money, assets, or an appeal bond covering the amount owed to qualify for an automatic stay. Messages seeking comment were left with Trump's lawyers and the New York Attorney General's office. Judge Arthur Engoron found that Donald Trump, his company, and top executives, including his sons Eric and Donald Trump Jr., schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. Among other penalties, the judge put strict limitations on the ability of Trump's company, the Trump Organization, to do business in New York State. The appeal ensures that the legal fight over Donald Trump's business practices will persist into the thick of the presidential primary season, and probably beyond, as he tries to clinch the Republican presidential nomination in his quest to retake the White House. If upheld, Judge Engoron's ruling will force Donald Trump to give up a sizable chunk of his fortune. Judge Engoron ordered Donald Trump to pay $355 million in penalties, but with interest, the total has grown to nearly $454 million. The total will increase by nearly $112,000 a day until he pays up. Trump maintains that he is worth several billion dollars, and testified last year that he had about $400 million in cash in addition to properties and other investments. New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, told ABC News that if Trump is unable to pay, she will seek to seize some of Donald Trump's assets. Trump's appeal was expected. Trump had vowed to appeal, and his lawyers had been laying the groundwork for months by objecting frequently to Judge Arthur Engoron's handling of the trial. During the trial, Trump's lawyers accused Judge Engoron of tangible and overwhelming bias. They have also objected to the legal mechanics of Letitia James's lawsuit. Trump contends the law she sued him under is a consumer protection statute that is normally used to rein in businesses that rip off their customers. Trump's lawyers have long argued that some of the allegations are barred by a statute of limitations, contending that Judge Arthur Engoron failed to comply with an appellate division ruling last year that he narrows the scope of the trial to weed out outdated allegations. If Donald Trump is unsuccessful at the appellate division, he can ask the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, to consider taking the case. The appeal is one of Trump's many legal challenges. He has been indicted on criminal charges four times in the last year. He's accused in Georgia and Washington, D.C. of plotting to overturn his 2020 election defeat to the Democrat Joe Biden. In Florida, he is charged with hoarding classified documents. English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, Justice and fight against corruption. These two virtues necessitate each other. Economic, moral, and political corruption are like tumors in the body of countries and governments. If found in the body of a system of governance, they would constitute a devastating quake and a heavy blow to their legitimacy. And for an establishment like the Islamic Republic, that requires beyond the common legitimacy and social acceptance, this is far more serious and fundamental than for any other systems. The temptations of wealth, power, and rank weaken some, even in the most resembling of all governments to Imam Ali's governance, that is, Amir al-Mu'mineen's own government. Thus, the hazard posed by the emergence of such a threat in the Islamic Republic, whose officials once competed each other in revolutionary piety and maintaining a simple lifestyle, has never been and still is not far from probable. This makes the constant presence of an efficient organization with sharp eyes and decisive actions within the three branches of powers, executive, legislature, judiciary, necessary in order to truly fight corruption, especially in governmental bodies.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the proportion of corrupt individuals among the officials of the Islamic Republic is much smaller than that of many other countries, and particularly to that of the Pahlavi regime, which was totally corrupt and encouraged corruption. And thanks be to God, the agents of this system have mostly stayed clean from it. However, even the slightest corruption is unacceptable. Everyone must know that economic transparency is the precondition for the legitimacy for all officials of the Islamic Republic. Everybody must beware of the evil of greed and avoid illegitimate earnings and supplicate to God to help them in this regard. Supervising and governmental organizations must prevent corruption from being conceived and fight its spread with sincerity and sensitivity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
in the limelight.
If Elon Musk was serious about free speech, as he claims, if he was serious about the right to information, he would never allow the banning of pro-Palestinian journalists and never entertain the thought of a past legislator and policy expert of an internationally condemned entity to head his content management. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in late November last year, ex and Tesla owner Elon Musk traveled to occupied Palestinian territories after facing blistering criticism of anti-Semitism from the Zionist lobby group Anti-Defamation League. Musk, one of the world's richest men and notoriously self-absorbed, was speculated to have embarked on the trip to save his image and business after shareholder value on X plummeted to the tune of nearly $75 million following the Zionist lobby's smear campaign against him. Musk was escorted to various locations in the occupied territories where Hamas resistance fighters bravely engaged the Israeli occupation forces during the events of October 7th operation. There, Musk was subject to photo ops by Israeli media, seen standing next to staged atrocities and fed the same disinformation that Zionist officials have in the past 4 months been brazenly peddling. Interestingly enough, Musk, surrounded by Zionist forces, refused to enter Gaza to hear the Palestinian side of the story, cowardly admitting that the besieged territory was too dangerous. The visit served as an opportunity for the Zionist regime to use one of the world's wealthy rich men and influencers as a propaganda tool. What followed the visit was millions of social media users wondering, what exactly did the Israeli lobbies say, do, or promise to the American multi-billionaire? It was already known that there was some level of collaboration between Musk's iteration of X and Zionist technology, as well as a vicious paid disinformation campaign on X run by Israeli officials. Upon Musk's return to the US, something was different. X users who previously slanted towards the Palestinian cause saw suppression of their voices and began to lose followers. Then came the heavy-handed crackdown. Pro-Palestinian journalists were suspended without warning, particularly those who were adamantly taking part in Zionist billionaire Bill Ackman and his richest attacks on Palestinian student groups. They were eventually reinstated after widespread public backlash. Musk, who, in his earlier avatar, claimed to be a free speech absolutist, has yet to comment on why these accounts were removed from his social media platform in the first place. Interestingly, the free speech absolutist, even prior to his trip to occupied Palestine, asserted that using or endorsing the world-famous slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," would result in a ban from the platform for advocating genocide. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu used this exact phrase only in outlining the full occupation of Palestine, which is resulting in an actual genocide and still exists on the platform. There is little doubt that Musk has submitted himself entirely to the Zionist lobby. Even before his ADL bout in November, Musk, whose father's wealth came from racist exploitations in apartheid South Africa, often sided with reactionary causes while protecting himself through humor and distractions. However, it must be soberly examined whether Musk was ever in any real control of X in the first place. Facts have surfaced that show Zionist infiltration of X even before the infamous Musk visit to occupy Palestine. Several high-ranking Israeli regime military personnel have been identified working for X and not in any small role. It has been revealed they specially work in positions of key influence at a popular social media company, specializing in content moderation and account suspensions. Take, for example, Michael Tochani, whose professional profile is readily available. Tochani works at the ex-Dublin office in a senior trust and safety position. Her resume is full of red flags. Not only was she an Israeli intelligence commander, but also worked for Netanyahu's National Security Council in 2015. Interestingly, she also worked for social media giant TikTok in a similar role, product policy manager. TikTok has also been notorious for banning pro-Palestinian voices, despite widespread and uncontested popularity of the Palestinian cause on the platform. Should a former assistant to head of legislation at an Israeli ministry be trusted to control and comment on biased moderation? How can one even retain a position knowing full well of their decades-long work at defending an apartheid regime, both through legislation and armed forces? There are others too. A hashtag on X seeks to expose various Israeli personnel, not just soldiers, but policy experts, influencers, and more in positions of unique influence using the hashtag IDFatX. Under this hashtag, you will find content moderators and policy specialists who can regulate who can say what. Their backgrounds include services in intelligence for Western militaries and agencies, as well as lobbying and think tanks. Most of the employees mentioned predate Musk's takeover at X Musk, who insisted he would free X and make it a playground for free speech, has brought in these moderators with sketchy backgrounds. Despite a mass firing and rounds of layoffs at the start of Musk's takeover, it seems that some of those who survived are uniquely in a position to defend the Israeli occupation. And these are just surface-level employees who happen to have some social clout themselves. Many would argue, so what? Saying past surveys in policymaking has no impact on grounds to create policy for a supposedly non-aligned tech company. By contrast, there are no employees, absolutely none, that are in any key position promoting the Palestinian cause or even any other foreign entity for that matter. There are no Russian or Chinese influencers or prior government officials of the same caliber as that of Israeli regime. Can you imagine if there were any Senate hearing committees who are currently conducting racist examinations of TikTok by accusing a Singaporean CEO of being a Chinese agent, would be gunning X left, right, and center. Musk would be under fire for employing CPC agents or Kremlin assets. However, Israeli intelligence seems to miss that critical bar. Tech giants like X and Meta have always been allowed to operate with near full impunity to sell user data and spy on users themselves at the behest of US agencies like the NSA and FBI. So much so that it is public record that various state agencies are routinely collecting data. It's no surprise that U.S. junior partners, especially ones with unique imperialist interests like Israel, are rarely critically examined when it comes to their own role inside social media giants. However, non-aligned or antagonistic nations that could have the same influence on Twitter find their influencers cracked down on. Musk's reeling in by Netanyahu and the Tel Aviv regime was not X being subverted post-October 7th. X, previously known as Twitter, was always subverted in one way or another, not only by agents who swear allegiance to the Israeli occupation, but by the U.S. State Department itself.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As a result of a broad consensus in Iraq to end the presence of U.S.-led international coalition forces from the country, both the Iraqi nation and government made it crystal clear that these military forces are no longer needed. Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-A'raji stated that all political factions in the country have agreed on the need to end the presence of U.S.-led military coalition purportedly formed to fight Daesh terrorist group.
Today, we're witnessing the negotiation with the international coalition forces, and honestly, what makes us, the Iraqi people, exasperated is the insistence by the U.S. to keep its troops on our land to have an intervention in the military scene of Iraq and neighboring Syria.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani stated that the Western Alliance mission will end at the Baghdad government's official request. He also said that the government is setting a date for the start of bilateral committee talks, which includes representatives of the military coalition to put arrangements to end the presence of international coalition forces in Iraq permanently.
We have collected more than 100 signatures and prepared the legal draft to end the international coalition mission in Iraq. And we pledge before God to our people that we will enact the law to expel the foreign forces from our land.
The demands to end U.S. military presence in Iraq are not new. After Washington's assassination of top Iraqi and Iranian anti-terror commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis 4 years ago, Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces who can endanger security and stability in Iraq and jeopardize civil peace.
Following the recent attacks on anti-terror forces and the continued violations on the country's sovereignty, the Iraqi nation and government are now determined to end the presence of foreign military forces to prevent any further escalations that can endanger the stability and security of Iraq. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Celebrating Iran's efforts and the evolution of its multilateral cooperation over the past century, the virtual exhibition of images, documents, and videos entitled Iran in 100 Years of Multilateralism looks at key milestones and achievements of Iran as an active member in international organizations, illustrating them with rarely seen historical photos, documents, and contemporary visuals.
The idea of setting up an exhibition like this one was proposed about 7 months ago. The main objective was to create a reliable source for research purposes. However, when we started collecting information and documents, we realized that the role that Iran has played in international organizations has been so significant that it deserves to be presented to the public.
This is also in line with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's approach.
Bilateral.
Multilateralism is very important. It is the only way to circumvent U.S. sanctions. Our people should be united, and I'm pleased to see that Iran is promoting multilateralism. BRICS is a symbol of this new policy, giving the Global South a voice.
This comes as the foreign minister has just wrapped up a two-day trip to Geneva, packed with bilateral meetings, not only with his counterparts from different countries from around the world discussing issues of bilateral concern, but also with high-ranking officials in the United Nations, including UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, all in line with rallying support for Palestinians under constant Israeli attacks.
I'm here in Geneva to reiterate Iran's stance on the current developments. Our government's policy is based on creating a network of cooperation and promoting multilateralism, because we believe this is the best way to overcome the challenges that we are facing.
Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister used the opportunity to draw attention to Israel's long history of unlawful behavior during the UN conference on disarmament.
The Iranian foreign minister called on the international community to demand the immediate nuclear disarmament of the Israeli regime.
And the special high-level meeting held on the sidelines of the 55th session of the UN Human Rights Council on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza once again highlighted Iran's role as a country that prioritizes multilateral cooperation. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Geneva.
Palestinians have taken to the streets across the occupied West Bank to protest against the Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip as it nears 150 days. Despite the bad weather and heavy rain, protesters roam the streets of Ramallah chanting for Gaza and demanding an end to Israel's war on the besieged Strip. People here say that Israel is using the war on Gaza to escalate its military measures in the West Bank.
Despite the Israeli non-stop crimes against our people and attempts to break their will, the Palestinians there in Gaza are steadfast and the resistance is still fighting. Wherever the Palestinians are, they are facing the Israeli illegal plans and violence and the killing that is everywhere, settlement expansion, Judaization attempts, and now the Israeli plans of eviction and attempts to break the resistance in Gaza that all Palestinians are embracing.
Also, amongst the demands of the Palestinian protesters is to shed the light to the suffering of the thousands of prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails under inhumane condition. In addition to the fact that the Israeli regime is using the illegal administrative detention that allows it to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial.
Prisoners are being held under a disastrous situation in Israeli jails. 7,300 were detained from the West Bank and over 2,000 from the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October. And we should not forget that over 4,000 have already been imprisoned before. So we're talking today about over 11,500 prisoners who are being tortured, humiliated, and maltreated. Hundreds are in serious health condition and they're facing a slow death.
With all eyes are focused on the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime continues stepping up its violence here in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli forces shot dead 4 Palestinians in separate incidents in Al-Farah refugee camp and Tobas town, northeast Nablus, and at Mazmouria checkpoint near Bethlehem, bringing the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the start of the war on Gaza to 411. Protesters today are stressing that no one is getting used to the Israeli genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip at the time when the regime's atrocities